From Rabbi Gelber. Rabbi Levi Gelber. So just very, very short, you know, don't get too comfortable in your chairs. So the bracha that Yaakov gives Yehuda is Yehuda ata yiducha achecha. So he said, Gvaldik Pshat, he said, if you take a look at prior to this bracha, Yehuda ata yiducha achecha, if you look at, take a look at the word Ivri Anochi, Ivri, every time it's mentioned Ivri, if you look at Targum Unculus, the words Ivra. From this point on, Yehuda ati duchachecha, if you mention, you look forward, you look at the word Ivri, Targum Unculus, is Yehudaya. So there's something in that bracha that we came from Ivrim, from passing through to Yehudaya. So there's more to that bracha than, you know, for every day that we can take through, that we're Yehudaya. That's it.
The
shofar? What shofar?
Tell us about the Holocaust. Tell us about that person. You have a relationship.
Oh, okay. So I did something. I got to go ahead myself into
it.
Okay, so I did something very controversial a few weeks ago.
Who's listening to something here?
Yeah, there's something there. I don't know where.
Someone has on a telephone. Siri doesn't understand what's going on.
So I did something very controversial a few weeks ago. Since I'm a child of Holocaust survivors, I'm sure many of you in the room are as well. So, and I did a lot of reading on Holocaust history. And as I get older, I always wondered what it's like. I'm a child of Holocaust survivors, but what is it like to be a child of a perpetrator? So, and you know, I go through, there's some Facebook pages that I visit that deal with Holocaust, second generation, so on and so forth. So I saw an interesting snippet about a group in Germany called March of Life. And March of Life, I don't know if any of you heard of them, March of Life is a German organization. They're somewhat church-based, but what they are, March of Life is made up of, their members are made up of children of Nazis. And what their mission statement is to fight BDS, to fight anti-Semitism in Germany and throughout the world, and also to basically put to task Germans for their kind of not dealing with the Holocaust in the proper perspective. And they, what they also do is they go to the various towns in Germany and they do the research on the German the Jewish community there. So, you know, they do good things. So I was impressed with what they do. And I sent them a message that I was introducing myself. I'd like to speak to one of them because, again, I always wonder what it's like from the perspective of someone who is the child of a perpetrator, what their experience is. So they sent me back a message right away. They said that they were very touched that I reached out to them, that they will be, they'd like one of their members to call me. And sure enough, about 3 weeks ago, I got a call from a gentleman by the name of Frank Pfeiffer, who lives in a place called Tübingen, Germany. And Tübingen is south of Germany. It's a university town. And we exchanged formalities and small talk, and then he got to the point. So Frank told me that his grandfather was a member of the SS. Not only was he a member of the SS, but he was a member of the Totenkopf SS. So reading about the SS is that many of the SS were comprised of volunteers from various countries in Europe, but the Totenkopf SS were one of the most, from all the units, they were part of the Waffen SS, but their task, part of the task of the Totenkopf SS was to provide guards to all the death camps and concentration camps. They also worked together with the Einsatzgruppen, basically the, you know, really from the Nazis, they were like the top tier of the bastards of the Nazis. So his grandfather was a member of the Totenkopf, And he told me that his grandfather was, and when he got, and as he grew up with his grandfather was an unrepentant Nazi. He was a drunk. And he would get drunk off, and he would sing anti-Semitic songs, and he'd get together with all his other buddies, and they were also singing anti-Semitic songs. And he was a Nazi to the day he died. But this Frank was born in 1969. So he told me that, you know, he asked his mother about like what his father did during the war, and there's just stories how he had a good time. There were they were just frying eggs, or, you know, the mention of a tank, and they did kinds of, they were running from here, they're running from the Russians, just, you know, nothing particular. So as the German archives were released, he decided to look at his grandfather's military record, and he was horrified. He was a real SOB. He joined the Hitlerjugend when he could get in, and even while he was in Hitler Youth, he already raped somebody. Okay, and in Hitler Youth, then he joined the SS, and he was all over Eastern Europe, and he said he was sure he has Jewish blood on his hands. He was all over the place, Poland, Russian front, and that was his grandfather's legacy, and he was very horrified by it, and he needed to see what penance that he could possibly do to live this horrible legacy that he has. From his wife's side, his wife's grandfather was one of the people, was an engineer. He was one of the people that designed the electrified fences in Auschwitz, as well as the electrical system in the crematoria and the gas chamber. Okay, so this is his wife's, this is the yichas this guy's got. And this grandfather had a son who is his father-in-law. And this son was also in the German army, and he was, but since he was younger, he was a rifle instructor, but he never actually saw action, but he taught shooting and all that, and training. But after the war, he was very horrified by what the Nazis did, so he became a pastor, and then when he was 85, he told this Frank that he felt he needed to do something to atone for the sins, so he went, flew to Israel, went to Yad Vashem, went to some kibbutz to apologize to survivors, and then went back to Germany, died a few days later. So this is in his group, this is the type of people that they have, and they're just very, they have, their heart is very heavy, and this is, so that's why they do what they do. So it's, you know, it's kind of controversial that I reached out to them. For, you know, for me, it was very difficult, kind of conversation. So on the one hand, we have Bnei Banav Shalhaman Limdator Bnei Barak. On the other hand, how do you deal with somebody like this? Do you invite him to the wedding? You know, what I'm saying is, do you invite him to, you know, like he comes to New York, do you have dinner with him? So these are some of the things that we spoke a number of times, and he said that he is, at least he's dealing with it. He said there are many in Germany, that there are many people that we read them in the Wehrmacht, who always, like, sometimes they get a free pass that they weren't involved in atrocities, but they were also involved in lots of atrocities. But Germany never really confronted it. They teach Holocaust, but always it happened to somebody. You know, that was then. Now, you know, we need to move on. You know, your grandfather probably wasn't involved. Your grandfather was involved. So they always take this viewpoint that their grandparents, yeah, they were in the war, but they were somewhere in Norway. They didn't know about. So this is, he said, but it's not true. He said, so he's very, very critical of German society. I was very impressed on what stuff that they do. So anyway, so that was my conversation. So I think it's something to throw out. Like, how would you view somebody like that? You know, do we take this person as the ally for, because in a few years, there are not going to be any more Holocaust survivors. And we need these people as allies to say, we know what happened because this is our grandparents who did this. Right? So.
Well, YouTube, you have certain people that converted.
Right. There are some like that, who that's how they dealt with it. He's dealing with it. But he said also, there are also other children of Nazis that also do this. But he said what they do differently is they take on, they have a responsibility. Whereas other children said, my grandfather was a murderer, he was horrible, and I'm going to talk about it, but that was my grandfather, I don't have to do anything. They feel they need to do some sort of a tshuva for what they did. So they fight against BDS, and they do a lot of stuff. And again, if you go on YouTube, it's called March of Life. I was very impressed. Also, that town that they live in is called Tubingen. So he said that's the other thing with Germany is the culture. They put this thing as how cultured they are. This we know already anyway, how cultured they are, and that education, all that, and the value. So that Tubingen, Germany, is a university town. He said 300 of their graduates were in the top echelons of the SS. These are people with PhDs, high form of learning, so this is what their legacy is. He said, and even in Tubingen, he said what he did, what their group did was that they went to show that they were up above everybody else. So they uncovered what during after Kristallnacht, how the whole town, like at a turn of a dime, they had nothing to do with their neighbors. They just kind of shunned them, and that. So he went to the mayor of Tubingen and he exposed them also as being a Nazi, to tell them that, you know, don't think it's somebody else. It's within you. It's everybody in Germany. So that's so.
The history shows that most of the generals were PhDs from the university. Yeah, yeah. Hitler recruited from the university, the Wehrmacht. Okay. That's what's happening now. The universities in America all like that, all left. That's what anti-Semitic.
On the other hand, if the this book called, I don't know if you heard of Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. Yeah. It's in the library by a guy by the name of
Yes. They had a special name.
They were Mischlingen, but but there were quite a number of Jews that, to protect themselves, the safest place to be was in the German army.
I read that book, yeah.
Yeah.
There were a lot of,
Brian Mark Krieg is the author.
There were a lot of Jews who had connections, who got a Hetemeyer Rabbanim from Mount Shemam, and they lived in Berlin.
They're called honorary Aryans. As a matter of fact, one of them was, and this is also said, Schmidt is so much Muslim from that book, because one of the people that was worked for the German Navy to design boats, missile boats, was a guy by the name of Fritz Mendelssohn. And Hitler Corps made him an honorary Aryan, and we know where he comes from. So he was a Nazi. And in Germany in the 1840s, 1830s, 1840s, after the emancipation, many Jews converted. So what happened 100 years later to their offspring, great, they weren't even, they were Nazis. You know, that's where I could go to. Oh, anyway, I just want to throw it out to people. Like, what do you think of something like this? Does somebody like this is irredeemable, that we don't want to have anything to do with them because he still has that blood, that shemitz of rishis in him that he still has? Or do we say, you know, let's approach him, let's reach out to him?
We think about the Kennedys. Look at what his father,
Joe Kennedy.
Okay, yeah. Right. There's no question. There are a lot of them, but we're talking about somebody who actually has Jewish blood in his hands. You know, who picked up a gun. You know, how do you?
Did Reish Lakish have Jewish blood in his hand?
No, he was a robber.
He was a robber.
Did he kill anybody?
Okay, but I'm saying, how do you? Again, how's the Torah view somebody like this?
You said
how
the answer yourself. The
motor. What? Neban Shalom. Okay, but what I'm saying is,
but
the thing is that for us, you tell us the Holocaust survivors, children Holocaust survivors. It's, you know, it's not so pushy.
No,
you know, it's not so pushy.
Yeah. There was one son of one of the top planners who actually may have been the architect for the concentration camps, who became a ger, went to learn America's a rav. He became a rav. It was a very big pesach. They wanted to take him as the chief rabbi of the army. And he told them, no way. What do you need, that they should say a Nazi became this?
Yeah.
So he moved to the old city and...
Yeah.
There's a lot of stories.
This is my own opinion. I don't think most people agree with it, but I think our mission today is not to make the Germans apologize. What? How can you expect somebody to apologize for what his grandfather
did? Right.
I mean, you know, there might be people in this room where we can have dissent.
He said they can never apologize. They said, but in terms of their hearts are broken for what was done.
Yes, that we go to them and we're preaching to them that they're guilty and everything. I think that's very, very bad.
Yeah.
But I think it's happening now that you have even a lot of yeshiva kids who do. We have to teach our generation.
Yeah.
The rabbis don't even know. The rabbis don't know. That's the biggest problem.
There was a boy in our shul, in my shul, you know, regular shul boy. He did not know what a ghetto was.
That's our fault.
He knows what's called Yisroel.
That is our fault.
He didn't know what it is. So there's a famous story where a boy sees someone putting on tefillin, and he sees there's a number, and he says to him, you know, excuse me, it's chatzitza. It's a chatzitza.
Yeah.
I like, a chatzitza, you know what this is?
Yeah.
And he didn't even know what it is.
Yeah.
But I think going out and teaching the goyim that you're guilty, I think that's very wrong.
Yeah.
But the Germans deny it.
Yeah, you do.
Obviously. There was an article a few years on Jewish action that the percentage of Geirim in Eretz Yisrael, the large percentage of Germans, they have the largest percentage of Geirim.
I mean, you have that. Look, Heinrich Himmler's granddaughter, but it was like, I don't know. I think it's probably a reform conversion. I don't think it was. She married an Israeli.
I can tell you a very fascinating story. I once heard with Rav Hutnitz Natsal that there was a bacha from the yeshiva. This is many years ago. There was a bacha from the yeshiva. He was engaged to a girl. You know, from girl, everything was fine. And all of a sudden, the boy's mother. He met her mother, and she was shocked. Her mother was a capo.
Uh-huh.
She was a capo. And so she recognized the capo, you know, there were thousands of people, but his mother recognized her. And she said,
this would have been the machatainist, do you say?
So let me tell you, this is what I read. It was a very fascinating story. So what happened is that she went, I don't know what, I guess because the son went to Chaim Blin, she went to Rav Hutna, and she told him, I cannot stand that my son, she had nothing against the girl, you know, it was her mother.
Yeah.
She had nothing against the girl. He said, I can't stand that my son is going to marry such a person. You know, I can't stand it. So they understood. So what they did was is that Rav Hutna got involved in the shidduch. And they said to the mother, you are right. But they didn't want to destroy the girl. You can't punish her because of a mother. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was very, so he made a whole tonight in the marriage that they had to pay a lot of money for the whole thing. And Gedolim went over to Rav Hutna and they said, what are you doing? Why are you breaking up the shidduch? He said, no. He would listen and he broke the shidduch. He broke, but the idea was to protect the girl. And then nobody should know.
On Monday or Sunday, I think Rabbi Wallace will be speaking at Bereski. If you read his book, he has a fantastic book called Incredible. And he goes into some family research and he finds out that one of his grandfathers was a German family that made Aliyah early. And he grew up in Yerushalayim, a blonde, blue-eyed kid who knew German, he knew Arabic, he knew Hebrew. And he decided what's going on, I have to join the British Army. And he joined the British Army, and they right away took him into intelligence because he didn't look Jewish and he spoke German. And they actually sent him into Germany, he should report back what was going on. And after a while, when the things got, when they started really persecuting the Jews, he said, I'm not gonna be involved with these Chai. And he somehow got an identity as a SS, and he would go work like in concentration camps, and he would work to save Jews. For example, Wallace brings a story, you should read it, he does it much better than I could probably say. And he brings a story that there was someone was caught with tefillin, and they were gonna hang him. And it was Wallace's great-grandfather, and he went up the front. And the German said to him, he says, you have a last wish? He says, yes, I want to address the people. And he started telling people, don't be afraid, we're going to survive this. I'm proud that I'm being killed because I wore tefillin. And they were seething because they had told him you can speak. And they were going to take and shoot him right away. And this officer walked by and he said, no, don't kill him. We're going to beat we're going to give him three times Malchus. You know? And they gave him, and he barely survived. And afterwards, he would have come. But if he wouldn't have done it, they would have killed him right away. So there were kapos. There's another story I know. There was, my mother always told this to me. There was in Veresky, you know, Veresky, Landos. In that town, there was a tailor whose wife did the work, and he, you know, he did the other work. And she said to him all day while she was a tailor, we're talking about 1920, and they moved to France, and the name was Steg, and he was arrested and sent to Auschwitz. And he was made a capo, and he came back, and the second he stepped into his house, his wife said, I heard you were a capo. If I hear anything bad about you, I'm kicking you right out. He had a phenomenal memory, and everyone would come line up by the door to find out the status of their parents or their family. They would walk in, they would say, don't worry, he'll come back, or he'll say, this is the yard side date, or whatever. But they knew that whenever he grabbed somebody in camp, you would hear screams and cries, whatever. He would bang the wall, you know, he had a deal going out that he saved people by banging. His son, who I think is 99, he's still alive, he's a doctor, he was the head of the CJUF, which is the Federation of France, who was a urologist. And in the 50s, when they were fighting in Algeria, he got a call that you're supposed to operate tomorrow on De Gaulle. If you leave him on the table, you'll never have to worry about anything for life. And he didn't leave him on the table. He cured him. So, and this son, also, you're talking stories. He was in school one day. He came back from school, and the concierge at the building grabbed him and said, they just took your father. Don't go up to your apartment. Stay here in my apartment. And after 3 days, he would let him sneak up to his apartment and get some clothes. He says, neighbors are talking. You better get out of there. So he and his brother survived, and they would join the resistance. And then he eventually came into the Jewish community. So that capital thing is also very...
Some
help. Not only that, if you were in that position, what would you do?
Some help or something?
A lot.
Then they killed the capo anyway. Right. Sometimes they said they had 10.
Yeah.
So at the end, they couldn't take
a lot, yeah.
Here's 9, take me to number 10.
Yeah. That's, my sister in law is Moshav in Mitzpenet Ofar. She had a neighbor for many years who now they moved to Yerushalayim. But I didn't realize who he was. My sister-in-law had told us over the years that she had a neighbor whose parents were, you know, Nazis, and that they converted to Judaism. And then she arranged, one time when I was there for a wedding, she arranged a ride for us to the wedding, and we got in the car, and I was talking to him. I know he's about 8 or 9 years older than I am, or 10 years older, had to be at least. And I said to him, so where did you grow up during the war? He said, Regensburg. I said, Regensburg? And then it dawned on me that this was the person she was talking to.
Did you jump out of the car?
But he's a Frumie. He has been for many years. And he said he was upfront about it. He has children who are Shomer Torah and Mitzvahs, because he converted many years ago. But my sister-in-law said that she got nervous because when he got word that his father-in-law, who's his father, that person's father, who's still, the last time we were there, they invited us to dinner in their new house in Yerushalayim. My wife and I went to eat with them. They're very nice Jews. It was just an incredible situation. But she said that she got nervous because when he got word that his father was sick, who was still alive in Germany, he decided at one point in time he had never spoken to him. But then they went back and he took his kids to visit the Zeit.
Wow.
And she said she got nervous that he was having a little bit of recriminations because this was still his father he wanted. He's still not like that. But my sister-in-law does for a living. She's a professor at university for over 30 years now. And what she does is she teaches a lot of Arab children, not children, I mean, I'm talking about people who are in college. So Druze and other people, and she's very much involved with an organization of Christians who are totally, and I've seen presentations, that they 100% believe that their only way to salvation, they remain Christians, is that for the Jewish Messiah to come. Yeah. They're not looking for to convert us, and they actually, and they have, he says, over 100, I've heard his speeches, and there's not one thing that you would think that is anything towards Christianity. He 100% believes in Judaism, and that Jews should remain Jews, and that's the only way for their salvation. And he has over 100,000 people who are in his matzah, in other words, who believe, and when he speaks, he packs them in all over the world. And there are these organizations that are trying to do it. I mean, maybe this is a sign of things that are eventually happening. You have these people who are little by little, who is, my son had a chavrusa who got smicha with him in YU, and his chavrusa was a convert. And his chavrusa was not only, he had to change his name. I think I might have mentioned this over the years. His chavrusa, all the rebbes know him. He used to daven by, on 15th Street, what's his name, Orpha J, across from the...
Rabbi Rutner.
He was a B'nai Bais by Rabbi Rutner. His father was a French galach, and he changed his name to Perlstein. Of course, a lot of these people don't change their last name. He said he had to change his last name. Of course, his original name was St. Croix. So, but he wrote, not only did he convert, but what he went through was, of course, he had only one brother who was still talking to him for a while, and then he said his brother stopped talking to him, his parents stopped talking to him, his father was a galach till the day he died. And it was from France. His father was a bishop, no less. But it bothered him about Christianity, all the things that were going on, and he felt this was wrong, but he did not become a Jew after he became a Christian. He became a Muslim, and he converted to Muslim, became a good Muslim for a couple of years, and he was a proponent of it until he saw what he saw became a whole, and then he was looking, he was like Yisro, he was a seeker, and he went ahead and converted to Judaism, and this goes back already 30 years ago, because he has a shtela in Toronto, he's married, and has a shtela in Toronto. Now he left the United States because he was meeting up, he couldn't get married, but in Canada he got a wife that was finally willing to marry him. And he's a very brilliant person. He's extremely educated. And my son had from him, he gave me to read, a 12 typewritten page treatise on his life about the differences, breaking down Christianity, the breaking down Muslim, what is wrong, why he left Christianity, why he let be, and why he became a Muslim, and why he left the Muslim religion, and why he became a Jew. And it answered all his questions. And now he wrote, it was beautifully written. I wish I had a copy. I thought I had a copy, but I see, I must have given it back to my son, and I want to ask him if he has it. Of course, it's worth reading. It's a great paper to show people to read it, because he's really a very educated person and writes tzimzach, you know, exactly what the problems are. But my sister-in-law teaches a lot of these people. The only problem I had was, she asked me, she came to my, when she comes in all the time, she asked me if I had an English on the Agadata on Brachas. So I did, but I said, who do you want it for? And she was learning Agadata with these people, and I said, I don't think this is appropriate. They're Goyim? And I said, I have a problem with that. So I said, I can't find it. But she
but
said,
she's
all right.
Law school.
I understand, but she wanted it just the Agadata. I mean, learn Ben Gemara. Agadata is going to destroy you on the, because if you don't get it, it's like when I worked for a few months in this place where they were Jewish, the owners, but they weren't from. And when I walked into his office the first time, I saw open up on his desk was a whole book on Kabbalah. And it frightened the life out of me. I was thinking to him, and I sat down with him one time and I said, I would like to know what you've reading it and you're studying it. What is the impression that you have and what are you thinking? Because if you're not a from Jew who has, I mean, really, a B'nai Torah, you can't appreciate things that it says. You can't process the information. It doesn't mean anything. And, you know, Rosie O'Donnell might tell you she studied Kabbalah.
Madonna.
She also did. You know, so what does it mean to them, Kabbalah? How do they process the information? Does it mean anything? I mean, when I read it to the Sefer Yetzirah, I got to a point where I was thinking, all right, I understand. And I put it down the minute I got to a page and I read one chapter three times and I couldn't figure it out, know how. I put it down because you can't get the wrong impression. If the worst thing that could happen is misunderstanding what you have, and I put it down. I figured maybe in 20 years I'll pick it up again and maybe I'm a little bit smarter and I'm a little bit of a deeper thinker. Maybe it'll mean something. But these are problems that we go on in the world.
20 years,
come back in 20 years. If my eyes are still working, then I can read it. Or I'll say, me, Meiros, not Reos. I've seen too much. And you had, because you mentioned the story, the interesting story that I still remember. Rabbi Hartstock, Olav HaShalom, he was a brilliant man, but what he did was he used to go to Europe and bring back things, look for people. That was what he did for years. And he said to me one time, we were talking, because I asked him Shilas, because he was a real Talmud Chacham. And I would ask him Shilas that I had in the Gemara. And he would explain it to me very nicely. He has a son who's a Rav, but his family. And he told me one time a story that broke him in a way, because he told me a lot of interesting stories about survivors from the war. And he said a person came to him, if you're going there, he had a sister who he doesn't know if she survived the war or not, but he had a feeling somehow that he had a sister that was still alive after the war. This goes back to the 60s already. And so he asked for her name and if he had any point of contact. He went to Poland and he started asking around. He did a little legwork. And lo and behold, he found this name, and he got a number, and he called up this woman, and it was this gentleman's sister. And when he came back to America, the lady asked him if you found me, this gentleman rather, asked if you found my sister, and he said, no, I never found her. And I said, but he said, this is why I didn't have the heart to tell her. So I made up to meet with her, and I got an address, and she wasn't there. I made up to meet in the lobby of a hotel, and she never turned up. And then finally he stayed after it, and he got another address to come and meet her. And the taxi drove up to this place, it's in Poland, drove up, it was in front of a church. And this woman was a nun. And so he asked her to come outside. He didn't want to go inside. But they came outside. He said the upshot of the whole thing was he thought maybe she told him that she has a brother who's still alive, living in Brooklyn. And after speaking with her for an hour and a half and trying to get something out of her, he said, you know what she tried to do in the end? She was trying to convert me to become a Catholic. He said, that's how bad it got. I didn't have the heart to tell her. So for every good story, you have these stories. Yeah. I had one story in my shul where the person who, in the Levaya, we were going through the name, and the people in the family told the story, and I said, the name, and I was talking about the name, and they told me afterwards, that wasn't our real name. Our real name is thus and so. But what happened is we use this name now because he was on a line that was, they were being shot in the firing squad. And as the next group was lining up, and there were like eight or nine of them there, and they were about to shoot all of them, one of the officers passed by and said, this man is my carpenter, and he's good. We could keep him. He does very good carpentry. And he pulled him out of the line. When the person who was next to him, a friend of his, saw that he was being pulled out of the line, he said, listen, I have a daughter, so-and-so, and you know her. I mean, they were friends. Please try to look after her and see. And he went back after the war to find this woman, and he found her. And she was in a convent also, not long after the war, so she was still young. And he said, this is, you know, I want to take her out. They said, well, what's your name? And she said, well, this is her name, so you're not family, so we're not giving her back to you. So what he did was he went and legally had his name changed to the same name as this girl, and then came back and said, I'm her father.
Wow.
And now they gave him the girl, and they were finally, it took a couple of years till the church let her go, and he took her and he brought her up. But this was a story, and now this woman, he said, that woman lives in, he moved to America, but this girl ended up, you know, when she grew up, she married, she moved to Israel, and she's a woman with a shekel, Rashid and Kinda, and he was able to save her. He said, that's the story of my father, and why our names are not this is our real name, but this is the name that we really have. There are these kinds of stories, and you look at Pashat Eden, and you think that they just, you know, they did a lot of things. When my father-in-law went back to Europe after the war, he went to Keveravos, and in 1969, when the plane landed in Budapest, and he got off the plane, and some police came to him, whose name was on passenger list, and they told him, plain and simple, we recommend you don't leave the airport, because if you do, we do not guarantee your safety. My mother-in-law didn't know what was going on, but what happened was, is after the war, since he had a lot of records and he had been in his town in Bardiyov during the war, after the war he was on run and he got to see a lot of things, and because he went back, he was hiding in plain sight, as I've mentioned, he went back and he lived in the basement. In fact, when I went back to his town, somebody grabbed me by the arm, a person who died recently, somebody was close to 100, and said, this is where your father-in-law, we fed him through this, he was fed through this pipe in the basement, they shoved food down this drain pipe to give him food. He went back after the war and took the coma on certain people in his town, and he had people killed. And there were still wanted posters out for him in Budapest, and they told him, so this is in 1969, they told him if he leaves the airport, they don't guarantee his safety. So he couldn't leave. But now he went back afterwards, later on, things changed much later. But things happen, and people who went through a lot of stories, these things happen. And we don't know the whys and the wherefores or where these people end up to be in their lives. And you never know. Sometimes these people turn out to be. Sometimes the person is an uncleus, and sometimes it's a mayor, and sometimes
we can't judge.
You don't know. And it's very hard when it happens in your own family, how you deal with it. And you can't judge anybody for it because it brings up terrible situations. And they even had on PBS, they were showing when they went back to Poland, one of my friend's grandchildren made a movie about his grandmother, and it was a 2-hour film, and it was the travels of his grandmother's family, my friend's mother, and he's a filmmaker, and he showed the film, and they went to the people in the town, this was in Krakow, and they were staying by the railroad tracks. And they said to this old guy who was a survivor, this goes back to the 80s, that this man was still alive, a very old guy, and he was standing there, and he said, do you remember the days, you know, way back then, and he was reliving the days when they put the Jews on the cattle cars and took them away. And he was standing there with his cane, standing by the railroad tracks, and he was going, and this is his facial expressions, and they commented on it, on the movie. And they said,
yeah, I remember that day. And they said, do you notice? He was give memory. He didn't remember it with a zitz. He didn't remember it with a kreft.
Yeah.
He had a grin singing. On his face when it reminded singing. Him of the day they took away the Jews. And he had a grin, and this is 40 years later, he was still reminding himself of that wonderful day when they took away Eden from his town.
Yeah.